Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. Leslie Odom Jr. is probably best known for Hamilton, where he originated the role of Aaron Burr. He won a Tony for his performance, and he left the musical in the summer of 2016. Since then, he's done a lot, appeared in Murder on the Orient Express, pursued a jazz residency, and become a spokesperson for Nationwide Insurance.
Nationwide is on your side.
Nationwide is on your side. He's also written a book called Failing Up. It's part memoir and part advice column. It's full of stories about Hamilton and also about his lengthy career in television. I got to ask him about representation and tokenism and the uncomfortable feeling of my being Team Aaron Burr. So stick around for my conversation with Leslie Odom Jr.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Microsoft Surface Laptop. At just under 3 pounds and with up to 14 and a half hours of battery life, Surface Laptop lets you binge watch your favorite shows whenever and wherever you want. Do more with Surface Laptop. Thin, light, and beautiful. Click, boom.
Leslie Odom Jr., welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So you open the book with a story about being in Hamilton and standing on the stage at the Richard Rogers Theater and kind of realizing that eventually you were going to move on from that. How did you know when it was the right time to make that move?
It's a great question. I think it's a feeling you have to understand. You probably do understand this. I mean, every job that I've ever had a start date and an end date. On my very first day, these are all limited things. Hamilton's the longest job I've ever had. I'm 36 years old. I've never had a job for a year in my life.
Yeah.
Where I went somewhere every single day and, you know, punched in and punched out. That was very new experience for me. And I don't know, so much of my adulthood, I don't know why this is, but it feels like it's been about holding two truths, you know, holding a truth in the left hand, a truth in the right hand that are opposites or paradoxes in some way, but being comfortable with that. There was something about in the middle of all that, knowing that there was an end date, knowing that I was going to have to move on, we were all going to have to move on, that made me appreciate it more.
Yeah. When you were doing that for such a long time, particularly if, as you say, it's the longest job you ever had, how do you continue to do that performance over and over again and make it fresh for yourself?
For me, it was presence, being in the room, not being a step ahead of it or a step behind, being in the moment. The moment will always offer you something fresh and offer you something spontaneous and something new. It only gets stale when you make it yesterday's news. When you're fast forwarding to the moment when you're not in the building anymore is when it becomes, you know, you're doing it by rote or something like that. I take a lot of pride in the fact that I really never did that. I knew how lucky I was. I think we all did. I knew how lucky I was to be on that stage doing that material at that moment in time. And I there was nowhere else I wanted to be. I didn't want to be in the past, and I didn't really want to be in the future. So I enjoyed every single moment.
Yeah. You talk about the email that you got from Lin-Manuel Miranda saying,
yeah,
do you want to come and participate in this reading of Hamilton? When it was still very early, how long did it take you to realize that that experience was going to make your life really different?
You and I were talking before we started recording. We were talking about how, you know, that's sort of social cachet, social cultural cachet in the bank, you know, about how early you saw Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
I get to play the card that I saw. I saw the very first reading of the show at Vassar. They were doing Act One. And I sat in the last row of that little tiny black box theater and had my, you know, mind blown, my head blown off, because it was just the freshest, smartest, most contemporary, exciting thing I'd ever seen. My favorite quote I include in the book, one of my favorite quotes is, an artist spends their entire life trying to get back to the place where their heart was first opened up. 20 seconds into that show, I was back to the place, you know, the show that brought me to the theater was a show called Rent that came out when I was 13 years old. And it was the Hamilton of its day in a lot of ways. That's where my heart was first opened up. And hearing those first eight bars of Hamilton is what that felt. It's what falling in love feels like. You know, really, it's you're carried away by something, and you become an instant fan. And my life was changed then. I was a fan of the thing. I never anticipated being in it. You know, I didn't know that that would happen, but lo and behold.
You talk in the book about crafting the character of Aaron Burr and his kind of somewhat unlikability. And it's a funny thing because I always want to ask people whether they think it's weird that I am somewhat team Aaron Burr a little bit through much of that show. What were your thoughts about hanging on to the humanity of that character who, from the opening moments, you know, is going to kill essentially the lead of the show or the co-lead of the show?
I thought that that Burr would be the avatar for the majority of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us are not Hamiltons.
So you don't think it's weird that I'm team Aaron Burr? You thought everybody might be team Aaron Burr.
I thought, whether they admitted it or not, I thought that a lot of people might see themselves in Burr. By that I mean, you know, Lin-Manuel is a rare once in a generation or a few times in a generation, you know, that kind of rare genius that, try as you might, like, you know, most of us are never good. You know, I could practice every day on the court, but, you know, if you don't have the size and the agility and the facility, you know, you're never going to play like Kobe, or you're never going to play like LeBron, you know? So, yeah, I thought that people would be able to relate to a character who is all smart and talented in his own right, but is looking at this kid alongside him who's extraordinary. I just tried to bring as much truth to that as I could and have as much courage to be. I thought I would settle for being understood instead of liked.
Yeah.
You know, Lin-Manuel walks in a room and, you know, he's just so doggone likable. And I had to kill that guy. I had to shoot the most likable person in the room, you know, maybe next to David, you know. Yeah. It's like I had to shoot that guy 8 times a week. And so it's like, okay, they're not going to like me as much as they like him. But if I do my job right, maybe they'll understand me.
Yeah. You talk a lot about the choices that you encourage young people to make. But I assume that you yourself have a lot more choices and different choices now than you did even 2 or 3 years ago. How are you going about navigating those choices now based on, you know, everything that's kind of changed for you since Hamilton?
That's a great question. When people would ask me, what's the kind of stuff you want to do post-Hamilton? I said, you know, I want to do all the stuff that nobody would let me do before Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't have any interest in, you know, doing the same things that I was doing before the show.
Right.
You know, there's so many new doors open and new people that I can work with. So now it's about priority. You know, my family's grown. I have a kid now. And, you know, it's about balance for me now in a way that it kind of has never been before. I really am trying to bring more balance to my life. You know, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to wake up, you know, 4 or 5 years from now and have lost the people and the things that matter most to me. How I'm navigating now is I'm really trying to stay in touch with what's important to me when and honor those things, you know.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you talk about having done before was a fair amount of television. There are a lot of TV shows that you have shown up on in various capacities, but there's a difficult story in the book when it's talking about the time when you were on Smash and reading a recap in which somebody had nicknamed the character Token.
Right.
I was trying to figure out as I was reading that, it was clear that it was a very difficult thing to read, but I was trying to figure out what part of it was painful, whether it was more that someone thought it was that or whether you sensed that it really was that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Of course. That's a great question. Just so you know, I really don't think there are many people that people don't want to be a token hire.
Right.
You're grateful for an opportunity, but nobody wants to believe that they were hired because they were Black or because they're a woman or, you know, Chilean or whatever. You know what I mean? Or, you know, nobody wants to, you know, people want to be valued for their skill set, for what they bring to the table, because, you know, you give in to the fact that, you know, you were hired to fill a quota. And right behind that is, you know, so you don't really deserve to be here like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not really as good as the rest of us. So you always kind of have those questions when you are the only, when you're the only anything. You're like, you know, is this tokenism? Am I token? But, you know, what I recount in the story that I tell is that I was doing my best to turn in a three-dimensional, you know, a fully embodied human performance, you know, trying to bring some truth and some humanity to this role. And you're doing my level best. And this writer cuts right to it and, you know, and renames me. I mean, just puts the label on my forehead. Token. Not this character is playing a token, or it's, you know, it wasn't a piece about tokenism. This was a recap of the show, a funny, in quotes, a funny recap of the show. And my name in every recap after I was introduced was Token. That sucks, you know? And it's not true. It's the other thing. You know what I mean? And that was my biggest, by the way, that was my biggest job before Hamilton. You know, prior to Hamilton, like, people would see me on the street and recognize me from Smash.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a tough thing. It took a dude who certainly understands a plight like that, you know, Lynn, who wrote a show and gave us the opportunity to shine and to fly in a way that no one had ever given us before, and but for him, no one may have ever given us, to remind us and to show the world that we got game too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
it's not tokenism when you hire David Diggs or Philippa Sue or Lin-Manuel or any of us, that we have a skill set to bring to the table, a valuable skill set.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about a conversation I had a while ago with the actor John Cho. And one of the things that he said was that when he was younger, he prided himself on being able to land parts that were written to be white guys. And he had felt like it's really good if I can come in as an Asian American actor and get a role that that wasn't written that way. But he said that as he got older, he started to appreciate roles that have some specificity or that don't necessarily do that. I'm wondering how you feel about that right now in terms of casting and all of these new opportunities and stuff like that. Do you care?
Oh, that's a great question, and that's well said. I totally understand that journey. We're in a very different moment now than when I graduated from college, you know, several years ago, 15 or so years ago or more. But, you know, when I got out of school, it was very different from, you know, the cats like Billy Porter and Michael McElroy when they got out of school, you know, where people weren't checking for them at all. If they were casting a black actor, it was like it was a gangbanger, it was a thug, it was a murder, rapist kind of thing. When I got out of school, it was like John was saying, it was, they were interested in this diversity thing, and you saw a fair amount of tokenism. You saw, you know, we're going to have the one black character, we're going to have the one Asian character. And these people, like he said, you know, were very rarely written. They were willing to cast an ethnic person, but they weren't written with that in mind. And so it's a tricky thing that happens. You get to work, which is wonderful, but you don't really get to the juice of who you are. You don't really get to, like, the marrow, that stuff that really brings fire and lights up a role and lights up a project. That comes from the specificity of who you are. And so when you're playing these sort of, you know, non-people, they have no specificity of region, they have no specificity of sexuality, or, you know, that's where you get your the good stuff comes from, all that. Now, you know, it's so different now. You know, the scene has changed so much. We have Issa Rae, Donald Glover, Lena Waithe, Shonda Rhimes. I mean, the scene is just so, you know, it's exploded in a way. So you're seeing the power and the beauty that you can get when you have an Issa Rae writing the specific experience, the nuanced experience of an awkward black girl. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Do I have time to tell a quick story?
Absolutely.
It relates to what you asked me. I went to see this off-Broadway show, Wild with Happy, at the Public Theater maybe 6 years ago. that Coleman Domingo wrote and was starring in. And it was four black people, written by a black person, directed by a black person at the Public Theater. And I went to see the very last show. I was busy. I went to see the very last show. It was astonishing, astonishing piece of work. I walked out of the theater. I was like, wow, I was really good. I was surprised that it was so good. And then I was sick that I was surprised it was so good.
Mm-hmm.
Because I realized, wow, there's no shade. This is all love. I can go see white people be brilliant any day of the week.
Yeah,
Little art house movies, little off-Broadway shows with, the specificity of who, they're telling their stories about what it means to be a white person at this time in history and this, grimy lifestyle and then an affluent lifestyle. All these specific portraits of white America, and they're brilliant. They shine. I'd never seen that on stage with black people. So that's why I was surprised. I wasn't even expecting it to be good.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you get. I saw a show that there was no translation on that stage. Those people were not taking words that weren't quite written about them and sort of trying to inject some of their personality. This was about black people in Philadelphia a week after mama just died and we have to clean out her closet and plan her funeral. Like, it is that specific, you know? So you got to see black brilliance on display, and it was a very special moment for me.
Yeah. I do want to ask you about something very, very different, which is you sang America the Beautiful before the Super Bowl this year.
Yeah.
Is the preparation different for standing in front of that kind of a crowd in terms, as opposed to standing in a small club or even a theater?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And Hamilton was great training for it. Hamilton was great preparation because, as you can imagine, I learned quickly that I didn't need to ask every single night. I didn't want to know anyway, but I didn't need to ask, hey, who's in the audience tonight?
Mm-hmm.
Assume that there's somebody out there whose opinion you care a great deal about. Somebody sitting out there, Steven Spielberg's there, Spike Lee's out there, Shonda's out there. Somebody's out mm-hmm. there that you care about. And so every single night was the Grammys. Every
yeah.
single night is the Super Bowl at Hamilton.
Yeah.
So, for me, what can take me off my game is if I focus on the wrong thing. If I'm focused on there's this many people in the stadium and there's this many people watching at home, I have to make that performance an intimate thing. I focus on what's in front of me. I focus on the personal connection that I have to the song and to the story. And I try to let that be enough. Because you want to honor the moment and you want to do well. But yeah, if I focused on fame or like audience size or
mm-hmm.
impact, those kinds of things, it would take me off my game because my focus would be in the wrong place.
Yeah. Well, it's funny to realize. I mean, you're probably right. There'd be no point in sitting there thinking X many people ever saw me in Hamilton and X many people are going to see me sing at the Super Bowl.
I wouldn't go out there. I'd be my legs would be shaking too bad.
Oh, this is so much fun. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Leslie Odom Jr.'s new book, Failing Up, How to Take Risks, Aim Higher, and Never Stop Learning, is available now.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers from Embedded. Bill Spencer works at a coal mine in Kentucky. And when I start to ask him about a future without coal, he knows what I'm going to say.
So if
coal goes out, I'm done for.
Coal Stories on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.